Chapter 23. Effect in disturbing the bird, whose sense of security was complete, and who hopped about the table with its quick head now on this side and now on that, turning its bright sudden eye on its master, as if he were no more than another bird. But how do you and your neighbor get on about the disputed right of way? Said Mr. Jarndyce. You are not free from the toils of the law yourself. The fellow has brought actions against me for trespass, and I have brought actions against him for trespass, returned Mr. Boythorn. By heaven, he is the proudest fellow breathing. It is morally impossible that his name can be Sir Leicester. It must be Sir Lucifer. Complimentary to our distant relation, said my guardian laughingly to Ada and Richard. I would beg Miss Clare's pardon and Mr. Carstone's pardon, resumed our visitor, if I were not reassured, by seeing in the fair face of the lady, and the smile of the gentleman, that it is quite unnecessary, and that they keep their distant relation at a comfortable distance. Or he keeps us, suggested Richard. By my soul, exclaimed Mr. Boythorn, suddenly firing another volley, that fellow is, and his father was, and his grandfather was, the most stiff-necked, arrogant imbecile, pig-headed numbskull, ever, by some inexplicable mistake of nature, born in any station of life, but a walking sticks. The whole of that family are the most solemnly conceited and consummate blockheads. But it's no matter. He should not shut up my path, if he were 50 baronets melted into one and living in 100 Chesney Wolds, one within another, like the ivory balls in a Chinese carving. The fellow, by his agent, or secretary, or somebody, writes to me Sir Leicester Dedlock, baronet, presents his compliments to Mr. Lawrence Boythorn, and has to call his attention to the fact that the green pathway by the old parsonage house, now the property of Mr. Lawrence Boythorn, is Sir Leicester's right of way, being in fact a portion of the park of Chesney Wold, and that Sir Leicester finds it convenient to close up the same. Apostrophe I write to the fellow, apostrophe Mr. Lawrence Boythorn presents his compliments to Sir Leicester Dedlock, baronet, and has to call his attention to the fact that he totally denies the whole of Sir Leicester Dedlock's positions on every possible subject, and has to add, in reference to closing up the pathway, that he will be glad to see the man who may undertake to do it. Apostrophe the fellow sends a most abandoned villain with one eye to construct a gateway. I play upon that execrable scoundrel with a fire engine until the breath is nearly driven out of his body. The fellow erects a gate in the night. I chop it down, and burn it in the morning. He sends his myrmidons to come over the fence and pass and repass. I catch them in humane man traps, fire split peas at their legs, play upon them with the engine resolved to free mankind from the insupportable burden of the existence of those lurking ruffians. He brings actions for trespass. I bring actions for trespass. He brings actions for assault and battery. I defend them, and continue to assault and batter. Ha, ha, ha. To hear him say all this with unimaginable energy, one might have thought him the angriest of mankind. To see him at the very same time, looking at the bird now perched upon his thumb, and softly smoothing its feathers with his forefinger, one might have thought him the gentlest. To hear him laugh, and see the broad good nature of his face then, one might have supposed that he had not a care in the world, or a dispute, or a dislike, but that his whole existence was a summer joke. No, no, he said, no closing up of my paths by any Dedlock. Though I willingly confess, here he softened in a moment, that Lady Dedlock is the most accomplished lady in the world, to whom I would do any homage, that a plain gentleman, and no baronet with a head 700 years thick, may. A man who joined his regiment at 20, and within a week, challenged the most imperious and presumptuous coxcomb of a commanding officer that ever drew the breath of life through a tight waist, and got broke for it is not the man to be walked over by all the Sir Lucifers, dead or alive, locked or unlocked. Ha, ha, ha. Nor the man to allow his junior to be walked over either? said my guardian. Most assuredly not, said Mr. Boythorn, clapping him on the shoulder with an air of protection that had something serious in it, though he laughed. He will stand by the low boy, always. Jarndyce, you may rely upon him. But speaking of this trespass with apologies to Miss Clare and Miss Summerson for the length at which I have pursued so dry a subject, is there nothing for me from your men, Kenge and Carboy? I think not, Esther, said Mr. Jarndyce. Nothing, guardian. Much obliged, said Mr. Boythorn. Had no need to ask, after even my slight experience of Miss Summerson's forethought for everyone about her. They all encouraged me. They were determined to do it. I inquired because, coming from Lincolnshire, I of course have not yet been in town, and I thought some letters might have been sent down here. I dare say they will report progress tomorrow morning. I saw him so often in the course of the evening, which passed very pleasantly, contemplate Richard and Otto with an interest and a satisfaction that made his fine face remarkably agreeable as he sat at a little distance from the piano listening to the music, and he had small occasion to tell us that he was passionately fond of music, for his face showed it, that I asked my guardian as we sat at the backgammon board whether Mr. Boythorn had ever been married. No, said he. No. But he meant to be, said one. How did you find out that? He returned with a smile. Why, guardian, I explained, not without reddening a little at hazarding what was in my thoughts, there is something so tender in his manner, after all, and he is so very courtly and gentle to us, and Mr. Jarndyce directed his eyes to where he was sitting as I have just described him. I said no more. You are right, little woman, he answered. He was all but married once. Long ago. And once. Did the lady die? No, but she died to him. That time has had its influence on all his later life. Would you suppose him to have a head and a heart full of romance yet? I think, guardian, I might have supposed so. But it is easy to say that, when you have told me so. He has never since been what he might have been, said Mr. Jarndyce, and now you see him in his age with no one near him but his servant and his little yellow friend. It's your throw, my dear. I felt, from my guardian's manner, that beyond this point I could not pursue the subject without changing the wind. I therefore forbore to ask any further questions. I was interested, but not curious. I thought a little while about this old love story in the night, when I was awakened by Mr. Boythorn's lusty snoring, and I tried to do that very difficult thing, imagine old people young again, and invested with the graces of youth. But I fell asleep before I had succeeded, and dreamed of the days when I lived in my godmother's house. I am not sufficiently acquainted with such subjects to know whether it is at all remarkable that I almost always dreamed of that period of my life. With the morning there came a letter from Messrs. Kenge and Carboy to Mr. Boythorn, informing him that one of their clerks would wait upon him at noon. As it was the day of the week on which I paid the bills, and added up my books, and made all the household affairs as compact as possible, I remained at home while Mr. Jarndyce, Otto, and Richard took advantage of a very fine day to make a little excursion. Mr. Boythorn was to wait for Kenge and Carboy's clerk, and then was to go on foot to meet them on their return. Well, I was full of business, examining tradesmen's books, adding up columns, paying money, filing receipts, and I dare say making a great bustle about it, when Mr. Guppy was announced and shown in. I had had some idea that the clerk who was to be sent down might be the young gentleman who had met me at the coach office, and I was glad to see him, because he was associated with my present happiness. I scarcely knew him again, he was so uncommonly smart. He had an entirely new suit of glossy clothes on, a shining hat, lilac kid gloves, a neckerchief of a variety of colors, a large hothouse flower in his buttonhole, and a thick gold ring on his little finger. Besides which, he quite scented the dining room with bear's grease and other perfumery. He looked at me with an attention that quite confused me when I begged him to take a seat until the servant should return. And as he sat there crossing and uncrossing his legs in a corner, and I asked him if he had had a pleasant ride and hoped that Mr. Kenge was well, I never looked at him, but I found him looking at me in the same scrutinizing and curious way. When the request was brought to him that he would go upstairs to Mr. Boythorn's room, I mentioned that he would find lunch prepared for him when he came down, of which Mr. Jarndyce hoped he would partake. He said with some embarrassment, holding the handle of the door, "Shall I have the honor of finding you here, miss?" I replied, "Yes, I should be there," and he went out with a bow and another look. I thought him only awkward and shy, for he was evidently much embarrassed, and I fancied that the best thing I could do would be to wait until I saw that he had everything he wanted, and then to leave him to himself. The lunch was soon brought, but it remained for some time on the table. The interview with Mr. Boythorn was a long one, and a stormy one too, I should think, for although his room was at some distance, I heard his loud voice rising every now and then like a high wind, and evidently blowing perfect broadsides of denunciation. At last Mr. Guppy came back, looking something the worse for the conference. "My eye, miss," he said in a low voice, "he's a Tartar." "Pray take some refreshment, sir," said one. Mr. Guppy sat down at the table and began nervously sharpening the carving knife on the carving fork, still looking at me, as I felt quite sure, without looking at him, in the same unusual manner. The sharpening lasted so long that at last I felt a kind of obligation on me to raise my eyes in order that I might break the spell under which he seemed to labor, of not being able to leave off. He immediately looked at the dish and began to carve. "What will you take yourself, miss? You will take a morsel of something?" "No, thank you," said one. "Shan't I give you a piece of anything at all, miss?" said Mr. Guppy, hurriedly drinking off a glass of wine. "Nothing, thank you," said one. "I have only waited to see that you have everything you want. Is there anything I can order for you?" "No, I am much obliged to you, miss, I'm sure. I've everything that I can require to make me comfortable, at least I'm not comfortable, I'm never that." He drank off two more glasses of wine, one after another. I thought I had better go. "I beg your pardon, miss," said Mr. Guppy, rising when he saw me rise. "But would you allow me the favor of a minute's private conversation?" Not knowing what to say, I sat down again. "What follows is without prejudice, miss," said Mr. Guppy, anxiously bringing a chair towards my table. "I don't understand what you mean," said I, wondering. "It's one of our law terms, miss. You won't make any use of it to my detriment at Kenge and Carboys or elsewhere. If our conversation shouldn't lead to anything, I am to be as I was and am not to be prejudiced in my situation or worldly prospects. In short, it's in total confidence." "I am at a loss, sir," said I, "to imagine what you can have to communicate in total confidence to me, whom you have never seen but once. But I should be very sorry to do you any injury." "Thank you, miss. I'm sure of it, that's quite sufficient." All this time Mr. Guppy was either planing his forehead with his handkerchief, or tightly rubbing the palm of his left hand with the palm of his right. "If you would excuse my taking another glass of wine, miss, I think it might assist me in getting on without a continual choke that cannot fail to be mutually unpleasant." He did so, and came back again. I took the opportunity of moving well behind my table. "You wouldn't allow me to offer you one, would you, miss?" said Mr. Guppy, apparently refreshed. "Not any," said one. "Not half a glass?" said Mr. Guppy. "Quarter? No. Then, to proceed. My present salary, Miss Summerson, at Kenge and Carboys, is £2 a week. When I first had the happiness of looking upon you, it was £1.15, and had stood at that figure for a lengthened period. A rise of 5 has since taken place, and a further rise of 5 is guaranteed at the expiration of a term not exceeding 12 months from the present date. My mother has a little property, which takes the form of a small life annuity, upon which she lives in an independent, though unassuming manner in the Old Street Road. She is eminently calculated for a mother-in-law. She never interferes, is all for peace, and her disposition easy. She has her failings as who has not, but I never knew her do it when company was present, at which time you may freely trust her with wines, spirits, or malt liquors. My own abode is lodgings at Penton Place, Pentonville. It is lowly, but airy, open at the back, and considered one of the ilfiest outlets. Miss Summerson, in the mildest language, I adore you. Would you be so kind as to allow me, as I may say, to file a declaration to make an offer? Mr. Guppy went down on his knees. I was well behind my table, and not much frightened. I said, "Get up from that ridiculous position immediately, sir, or you will oblige me to break my implied promise and ring the bell." "Hear me out, miss," said Mr. Guppy, folding his hands. "I cannot consent to hear another word, sir," I returned, "unless you get up from the carpet directly, and go and sit down at the table as you ought to do, if you have any sense at all." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.